live in the islands.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In the mid-90s, the Enron Corporation was the hot, red-hot superstar in the energy business, but that star has imploded into a powerful black hole, sucking up retirement funds, investor dollars, and public confidence in 90s-style business as usual. In the largest bankruptcy in the history of capitalism, Enron executives walked away with millions of dollars in their pockets, suggestions now of insider trading, and a long legacy of mutual back-scratching in Washington. How is the Bush administration involved, and whatever happened to corporate governance? Is Enron's self-destruction indicative of deeper problems in the way that U.S. corporations and Washington have come to relate? This hour, the spectacular collapse of Enron and the growing black hole it left behind. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're joined this hour from studio in Vermont by our special coverage news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Also joining us on the line from Washington is Jonathan Alter, senior editor and political analyst extraordinaire at Newsweek magazine. Welcome, Jonathan Alter.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming on. Jonathan Alter, how bad is the damage in Washington? Where's it going?
Well, you have to look at two different stories. First, you've got the corporate scandal, which is huge. I would be amazed if there were not people who went to jail by the time this is over.
Like who?
Enron Corporation. Well, It's a little early to know exactly who it will be, but you have real indications of serious wrongdoing at the highest levels of Enron and also within the Arthur Andersen accounting firm, where they had a barbecue of documents, at a time when it was clear that those documents were going to be relevant to an investigation. And that somebody is going to pay for that. So
and John Dingell saying today that there is pretty strong evidence of insider trading here. And, of course, he's the ranking Democrat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. So
well, what you had was they call it self-dealing, where it's a little bit different than insider trading, but it's in the same area where you had some executives who set up their own side deals, their own kind of companies within the companies.
Right.
They would use that to hide the staggering debts of Enron and also to enrich themselves at the expense of Enron shareholders and Enron employees.
So that's the corporate scandal, or at least a piece of it. You say there's another political scandal. How is it? How does it compare at this point, and where might it go?
Well, I think actually it's too early to call it a political scandal. We don't know enough yet, and it is not nearly as big as the corporate scandal, if indeed it does turn out to be a scandal. But we don't know. We don't know at this point. But the early indications are that despite an extraordinary level of influence that Enron had within the United States government, you had more than a dozen senior officials who were shareholders. You had very close ties between George W. Bush and Enron. Enron was his number one single largest campaign contributor, gave him over $500,000. But despite all that, there is not evidence yet that the Bush administration acted improperly. And in fact, Undersecretary of the Treasury Peter Fisher, who's from your neck of the woods there, grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When Enron called him to lean on him, and even when former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin from the Clinton administration called representing Citibank, Fisher basically said, look, it's not the government's place right now to be bailing these guys out.
But Jonathan Alter, this brings us to pretty much the point we want to look at tonight, which is corporate governance. Is it possible that by doing nothing when those calls came in, that's in a funny way as indicative of a problem as if they had done something? Shouldn't alarm bells have gone off maybe in the immediate aftermath of those calls? And step back with us for a second and look at the larger picture of the relationship that emerged in the late 90s between Washington and the corporate world. What's happened to corporate governance there, Jonathan Alter?
Well, I think you have to start with what I think is going to be the most fruitful area of inquiry, and that's the regulatory oversight or lack of oversight. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the chairman of that commission, Curtis Ebert, who was a Republican, was contacted by Ken Lay, the CEO of Enron, and lo and behold, he didn't see things the way Enron saw them. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, 8 months after he's appointed by President Bush as chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, he resigns, and a Bush loyalist from Texas is put in his place. So I think there are going to be a lot of regulatory questions about who knew what when, not in terms of, you know, who knew in the White House, but who knew among those who were supervising or should have been supervising Enron, and who knew not just about the financial problems, which came about very quickly, but did they do the bidding of Enron? Was there too much of a hand-in-glove relationship? Because Enron was like an octopus. I mean, it had its tentacles mm-hmm. absolutely everywhere, including on Capitol Hill. About 70% of its contributions went to Republicans, but there were an awful lot of Democrats who also received campaign contributions. And in that sense, as you say, it's emblematic of what happened in the United States in the last 15 or 20 years, where even the Democrats have become very much the servants of corporate interests.
Jack Beatty, I want you to jump in here with us. This is, in a way, maybe what it's all about. Jonathan Alter is pointing at the regulatory failure here, but isn't that somehow part and parcel of the entire political atmosphere that's developed?
I think so. I mean, President Bush is apparently reading a biography of Theodore Roosevelt, and in there it tells of how Roosevelt signed a law in 1907, essentially keeping corporate contributions out of campaigns. Well, that law went by the books in the 80s and 90s with soft money. And the result is, I think, what we see, a company that could buy its way into the Congress. It apparently went into this, what Paul Krugman calls a regulatory black hole, thanks to a bill passed by Phil Graham, one of its recipients. And it received all sorts of help from the administration, at least early on, according to, I mean, there's the meetings between Vice President Cheney and Mr. Lay. There's the shaping of the Bush energy proposals quite around what Enron wanted. But this is indicative. I mean, it's a moment when we're back really to where we were around the turn of the century, when the growth of the corporation has so far exceeded the government's ability to regulate it that all the dams are down, and that 70% of the public now, according to Business Week, thinks corporations have too much political influence. That's a reverse from the 1960s, when that percentage had that feeling about labor. And of course, now corporations outgive labor 10 to 1. So we're in a situation where there's no law, absent campaign finance reform, to prevent corporations from exercising the kind of influence over government that the public pretty much unanimously thinks they have.
Jonathan Alter, what about that? You say there's no direct evidence of a political scandal at this point, and yet the surround here is so tinged with political compliance.
Well, you know, the scandal is what's legal. I mean, Michael Kinsley once made this point, and it's an excellent one. We have a system of basically legalized bribery in the United States where these campaign contributions are given in advance of key votes in the Congress, in advance of key decisions in the administration. And until we have some kind of campaign finance reform, this process is not going to be reversed. Now, campaign finance reform did almost miraculously pass the Senate this time, but it was held up in the House of Representatives. And we'll see whether Tom DeLay and Dennis Hastert and the Republicans who run the House of Representatives feel any more pressure as a result of the Enron scandal to do something about campaign finance reform. But that's what I think is the more likely outcome of this. I don't see a situation where you have, as in some of the earlier scandals we've had, large numbers of members of the administration resigning in disgrace or even being prosecuted because we've gotten to a point where so much of this influence peddling is perfectly legal.
So you don't see another Whitewater, another Iran-Contra, another scandal eating up Washington's time and energy, paralyzing the Capitol?
Well, I do think we have a scandal machinery that will get geared up. There are a half dozen investigations underway, and Capitol Hill will hold, you know, hearings on this, and there will be a fair amount of attention, but you know, on the one hand, it's much bigger than Whitewater ever was in terms of the size of what and scope of what went on. But we're also at a different point historically, where a lot of the American people are very concerned that, you know, nothing else detract from the war effort and the effort to prevent another September 11th. You have a president who has tremendously high approval ratings, and in Washington, that's very relevant, whether it should be or not. Washington senses weakness and shies away from strength, and right now the president's in a strong position. But it all is dependent on the revelations. If something were to come out that would, you know, would show something dramatic that we don't know about, that what I've just said could change overnight.
So you don't smell blood in the water yet, but oh, what a business debacle.
Yeah, I do smell a little bit of blood in the water, but not a some sort of a huge political scandal. I think the corporate scandal is big enough that it'll occupy a lot of time, and all the political angles and connections will and should be explored. I just think that you know, because there was not an effort to save Enron's bacon and to, you know, come to the aid of these big contributors like Ken Lay, It makes it a little harder for the Democrats to get traction on it as a political scandal, but they may well benefit from the fact that it just heightens and accentuates these class lines in American politics that some people would like to erase or obscure, but are very much there, where the little guy got screwed big time on this story. And if it reinforces the point that from the tax bill through a lot of other policy, you know, the rich have been getting richer and the poorer and the middle class squeezed, then that ultimately could, even if there's no big political scandal, work to the benefit of Democrats.
Jonathan Alter, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Jonathan Alter is senior editor at Newsweek magazine. We're joined now by Kurt Eichenwald. Kurt Eichenwald, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
We're great, thank you. Kurt Eichenwald, you had a tremendous piece in the New York Times yesterday outlining the entire long, sad TikTok of Enron's unraveling. We've just got a minute before the break here, but give us in a nutshell what lines were crossed here and by how far were they crossed?
Basically, the lines of all financial propriety. And the degree to which they were crossed is about as far as you can go. This was a company that for all of its big girders and mm-hmm. name put up all over the place and all its power and influence, it was managed in an incompetent and reckless manner. And we're now seeing the results.
We're wondering here tonight about where corporate governance has gone to when this can happen on such a scale. In a nutshell, before we've got to take a quick break here, what's happened to corporate governance? Where did it go?
Well, corporate governance was never really there. We haven't been very strong in demanding really good oversight by boards of directors over the years. And in this instance, you know, the boards of directors at this company, just like at many other companies that are caught up in scandal, really were not looking, really just looked at the rising stock price, looked at the increasing revenues, looked at the increasing profits and say, gee, everything must be wonderful.
But somehow, wasn't there a 90s zeitgeist at work here that said, look, we're onto a new terrain, the old rules don't apply, never mind about how we keep the books, let's just move?
Well, nobody. I don't think anybody would ever openly say, never mind how we keep the books. They would have even thought about it. I mean, the problem with success, I've seen a lot of companies get caught up in scandal. And the problem with companies that have enormous amounts of success is they begin to believe their own hype. They begin to believe that they are, in fact, geniuses. I saw the same thing with Drexel Burnham in the 1980s.
Kurt Eichenwald, hold the thought right there. We'll be back in just 1 minute. We're talking tonight about Enron, its meltdown, what it's the impact of that meltdown may be for Washington, what it may be for you. What lessons do you draw from the collapse of Enron? Is this a travesty, or as Treasury Secretary O'Neill says, is it just capitalism? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Enron scandal, the corporate scandal, and maybe something more, maybe something that may even affect the U.S. government's capacity to pursue the war on terror. We don't know how far it's going to go yet. So far, not too much blood in the water in Washington, but the tide is rising and the story is not yet told. We're joined by Kurt Eichenwald, reporter for the New York Times, who had the sort of definitive blow-by-blow story of Enron's rise and fall in yesterday's Times. Kurt Eichenwald, you say that almost every line was crossed here, and by a fair piece. Take us through sort of point by point where lines were crossed.
Well, Enron, you have to start with what it is at its foundation. Mm-hmm. At its foundation, they would dispute this, but at its foundation, they were a trading operation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they became. I mean, the Enron that we're talking about was a trading operation and a fairly spectacular one. Mm-hmm. They did a good job at that.
Mm-hmm.
Then they ventured out into businesses that make very little sense. They wanted to be one of the world's best, largest suppliers of water, and opened up a giant water facility.
So from natural gas to water.
Yeah, they decided they wanted to be a major player in the broadband industry. They decided that they were going to build major plants over in India. And basically, you know, for all the skills they had at training, at trading, every time they went into one of these other businesses, everything they touched turned to mud. They lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 billion invested in this.
So their core competency, as we used to say here, of energy trading was a good thing, and they did it well. But beyond that, not so well. And what lines did they cross trying to save themselves once that began to go bad?
Well, the problem that they had is they were so clever with their financing, and sometimes in business, cleverness can you can have very smart people who aren't very wise.
Mm-hmm.
In this instance, they were utilizing a bunch of partnerships that were kept segregated from the company, and moving these assets like the water facilities into the partnerships so that they wouldn't appear on their books. The assets would be off the books. The debt would be off the books. And the company would look very, very clean. It would be, you know, the equivalent of showing the doorway only of a demolished building.
So who should have caught this?
The accountants, the board of directors, the management of the company never should have been doing it in the first place. The chief financial officer, I think, bears a fairly sizable level of responsibility, since he was involved as a managing partner of the partnerships. And in the end, once these partnerships effectively began sucking up the money of the company,
mm-hmm.
and they were joined together back into Enron, the company was on the downward spiral toward destruction.
So
you can only play games so long until the game ends.
So, Kurt Eichenwald, put the pieces together for us. And was there something about, in your mind, the atmosphere created by government oversight or its absence in the late 90s that encouraged this? What are the connections between what happened in Enron and the message being beamed out of Washington about what's required and not required of a responsible corporation today? Or is that even the source of what happened here?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, Enron, like most trading operations, ran on hubris and adrenaline. And ultimately, most trading operations have within it someone who is there to say no, mm-hmm. someone who is there to put the brakes on. Everyone at Enron was running on the same adrenaline, and for some people that's a very thrilling, you know, way of working. For others, it was a way of being able to go down paths they wouldn't be able to go down any other place.
Mm-hmm.
As they got bigger and their stock went up more, it reinforced their own mentality of themselves, And people like Ken Lay began to believe that they had not only the authority and the power, but practically the duty to dictate to the government how things should run.
And the government took it.
And the government responded because, after all, this was Enron. They were not only were they big contributors. I mean, we can't just look at it as contributors. If they were contributors of a lot of money and they were running a company that was a bust, mm-hmm. I don't think it would have had much attention or as much attention. But these guys were you know, the fastest growing, most successful in this field.
They looked like a powerhouse.
They were a powerhouse. They had a sense of inevitability about them, and everybody was a true believer. And in the end, you know, Washington didn't quite know what this company was. Some of the company's managers didn't quite know what this company was. And ultimately, when we all found out, the pieces came apart.
Kurt Eichenwald, we know you're in Houston and catching a flight back to New York. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Kurt Eichenwald is a reporter with the New York Times. Jack Beatty, you hear his description there, and he's gone through in a meticulous way and looked step by step at what happened. But still, Kurt Eichenwald is looking pretty much inside the walls of Enron. He's not yet making that leap to look out at the political surround, at least not too strongly, not yet.
Yeah, and it's the political surround. It's also the ideological surround. One of the reasons Enron had this luster was that it was all about energy deregulation and the opening up of markets. And there was a kind of invincible belief in the 90s that that was the path, that marketizing everything was the path to greater prosperity for the country. And we have a similar sort of application of ideology now in the fall of Enron. We have Mr. O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, saying that this is just capitalism. People get to make good decisions or bad decisions, and they get to pay the consequences or enjoy the fruits of those decisions. Wait a minute. That's a statement of ideology. It is not a statement that matches the facts here. The people who did well were the people who made the mistakes. It was Ken Lay and the rest who feathered their nest. The people who paid were the stockholders and the victims of this semi-fraudulent self-dealing that was going on. So the government response to this is just pure ideology. This is capitalism.
But capitalism does have winners and losers, doesn't it, Jack?
This statement doesn't derive from the facts of mm-hmm. what's going on now. This mm-hmm. isn't about punishing, you know, losers. The losers were the people who had no chance. And you know, this is a systemic problem. Morgan Stanley, the investment bank here, they could, at the one hand, evaluate Enron, have their analysts talk about it, and on the other hand, they could back Enron's financial ventures. That's legal, according to the SEC. The accountant could do the same thing. On the one hand, could warrant the books. These are fine. They're open. And on the other hand, could be involved with, consultant deals with the company. This is a systemic problem.
Jack,
having to do with our whole belief about the, you know, just superiority of unregulated markets.
Let's see what listeners have to say about that. Should corporate governance be tightened up? Can we do that without suffocating economic evolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255, and you're welcome to join us. We're joined now by Donald Lessard. He's Deputy Dean of MIT's Sloan School of Management. He studies corporate management and risk and knowledge management in business. Good evening, Dean Lessard.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Look at this with us from a management point of view, if you will. Put yourself inside the head of Kenneth Lay, if you're willing to go there. What do you think gave him the sense of liberty to take Enron's reporting and practices and structure and kind of freewheeling style to the extent that it was taken? Was this just desperation in the end? Was it hubris and adrenaline, as Kurt Eichenwald said? What was it?
I suspect that the hubris and adrenaline have a lot to do with it. Even though this company was operating in some very sophisticated financial products, it sounds to me like they went wrong on some very basic things. And the point the two previous speakers have made that, you know, there wasn't a differentiation between the people who designed the systems, the people who traded in the systems, and the people who monitored the system. The same people did all the same things inside the firm and outside the firm.
So here's a huge publicly traded company, lots of attention from Washington and from Wall Street. How could this go unnoticed, or how could there be a culture inside that said, we don't need breaks here?
Well, I was surprised by the culture inside because I visited several years ago looking at their project site, and frankly, I was impressed the way they differentiated between prospectors and analysts and investors. So at least in places of the firm, that discipline was very clear. Somehow, I think in the trading culture of the firm, it wasn't quite so clear. Clearly, the trading house of the side of the house and the project side of the house were vying for being on top.
Yeah, I guess so. Is this something that Washington should have, could have, tomorrow might or will be more mindful of? You know, should Washington have been minding the store here, or is this, does it really go back to Wall Street in your mind?
I'd say both. Washington, Wall Street, the accounting profession. If we look at the accounting role, we had the same guys designing trading and risk management systems, reporting and monitoring those and reporting on those. It seems to me like you'd like to say at least one of those roles should have been played by someone else. And the SEC had been making that case and was beaten back. I think that needs to come back. Inside, the board of directors should have said, look, if one set of people are designing the systems and running them, we need someone else looking at them. One out of three ought to do.
Yeah, one of three at least. And what about the whole new economy dynamic or lack thereof here? Was Enron, was part of what was fueling it was a sense that it was breaking new ground, and that bought it an extra degree of tolerance?
Oh, I think so. I mean, this is, in some sense, it's like the whole bubble that went with the dot-coms also. People were willing to suspend judgment on whether these models were really working because they saw a whole new set of economics.
But how do you break through to new models if you don't loosen up a little bit?
It seems to me Enron was doing many things that were right and many things that should stick, but some very basic old rules were not followed, like the one out of three in terms of the watchers and designers, and like some old rules that no firm should be more than a certain percentage of a given market.
Don Lessard, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Okay.
Don Lessard is Deputy Dean of MIT's Sloan School. We're joined in the studio now by Robert Kuttner. Robert Kuttner is editor, founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. Has written at some length about the whole Enron scandal. Thanks so much for coming in tonight, Bob.
Happy to be here.
You hear what our guests are saying one after another here. We've got a picture of a kind of hubris, of adrenaline, of two sides of a company fighting for dominance, of Wall Street sort of winking and willing to go along because it was such a powerhouse. In Washington, I guess like a lot of other people, not knowing quite what to make of it, but certainly not throwing on the brakes.
Well, I think the really interesting thing here is how the political scandal connects to the corporate governance scandal. And I think they ultimately do connect in the following way. And as Jack Beatty was saying before, they connect at the level of ideology. There's an ideology that says you just need to leave corporations alone, markets will regulate themselves, and that's all there is to it. Government should get out of the way. Enron spent a lot of money buying influence, and it did so through its allies in the Republican Party. And it's not a question of whether leading officials in the Bush administration did anything in the end game. I mean, Bill Sapphire in this morning's New York Times sets the bar of scandal so low that it's sort of impossible to cross when he says, well, look, where's the scandal? They called the government didn't do anything, so there's no scandal. That's not where the scandal is. The scandal is 2, 4, 6, 8 years ago when Enron was so enmeshed with the Bush crowd that they were able to buy their way into a lax regulatory environment and at the federal level.
Bush crowd, but 2, 4, 6, 8 years ago were Clinton years.
Yeah, but at the state level, they were very much Bush years and they were Republican years. I mean, they bought lobbyists to buy influence in both parties. And I think this is where the political scandal, and it is bipartisan to some extent, connects to the corporate or the regulatory scandal. I like to say you had five different regulatory lapses. You had a lapse of energy deregulation, electricity deregulation, where Enron was both trading and it was also assembling a great deal of market power, so that when California was really taking it on the chin, some of the fault is laid at the door of Enron.
Are you saying you're against deregulation there, Bob?
Well, I'm saying this particular kind of deregulation allowed companies like Enron to tie up supply and control price.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way deregulation is supposed to work. Secondly, you had a failure of pension regulation so that the big guys could sell out their positions and the ordinary workers who had a few $100,000 in a 401k got completely screwed.
In other words, their 401k dependent on Enron shares and down the tube.
Right,
those went.
And the big guys could dump out while the little guys had to hang on. Thirdly, you had a failure of the accounting profession. And let's not forget that public accountants who are supposed to keep the books of these companies honest, they are surrogates of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Securities and Exchange Commission, since the 30s, has been charged with making sure that there's transparency, that corporations have fair, uncooked books. And that authority is delegated to accounting firms like
mm-hmm.
Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
So Anderson is asleep at the switch. The SEC is asleep at the switch. Here's Harvey Pitt, who is now Bush's appointee. He's the new head of the SEC. The previous head of the SEC, Arthur Levitt, spent 8 years trying to make sure that companies like Anderson could not be both consultants and auditors of the same corporation. First thing Pitt does when he gets into office is he kills that rule. So you have a failure of securities regulation. And finally, of course, you have a failure of campaign finance reform. Lay and Enron are able to buy into both parties, disproportionately the Republican Party, but to some extent both parties. The press has only begun looking into what Enron was able to buy at the state level. It buys a regulatory climate so lax that nobody can figure out what these guys are really up to. The books are cookbooks. Nobody can figure out the books, not even their own auditors.
Isn't it really a bipartisan issue here, though? I mean, as you say, this happened through the 90s, and those were Clinton White House years. You're coming back to the Bush tag on this, but
well,
don't both parties really have something to answer for here?
Yeah, I think both parties do, but there was a particular closeness between Ken Lay and the Bush operation. Lay was very close to Cheney. Wendy Graham, the wife of Phil Graham, is on Enron's board. Lay was the biggest in Enron, biggest single contributor to the Bushes. So I think there's a particular affinity with the Bush operation. It's true that both parties, to some extent, are in the tank. But I think, in fairness, the Democrats are less into this whole deregulation mystique than the Republicans. And it seems to me, at the end of the day, this shows the failure of the mystique, which says all you got to do is let markets work. The fact is, and this goes back as old as the history of capitalism, there are scoundrels out there. And certainly since the 1930s, to some extent since the 1890s, we've known that a market economy, as wonderful as it is, cannot totally police itself. And the one aspect of regulation that even Wall Street has always supported is securities and exchange regulation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to have capitalism, investors need to know that the books are honest books.
Mm-hmm.
So the most fundamental failure here is that these were cooked books.
Jack Beatty, Robert Kuttner's singing your song here, but he's making the same case that there's an ideological factor behind the most of this.
Yeah, and it he talks about going back to the 1890s. I mean, it even goes back to Adam Smith, who was the godfather of so much of this this market ideology. He said the problem with corporations was that it entrusts with – it gives managers unanswerable power through which they can be guilty of what he calls negligence and profusion. There's no one to watch them. And this problem of governance has always been there for corporations, but in our time we've seen it severely weakened. And this whole the part of the scandal here having to do with boards.
Jack, I got
to
jump in. We'll come back right after a break. A lot of callers coming in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is Tom Ashbrook, WBUR, Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the Enron debacle and the political climate in which it unfolded. How does the embrace of business and politics here look to you? Who wasn't minding the story? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in this segment by Robert Kuttner. He's founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine and by our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, and by a lot of you who want to get on the line with us. Tom is on the line right now. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're good, thanks.
I had a couple of quick points. Number one, there was an interesting book written a couple of years ago about a lot of these issues by a Wharton Business School professor called Investor Capitalism, which some of your listeners might want to check out. But my point is, you mentioned earlier about the conflict of interest with consulting firms, or excuse me, auditing.
Yes, accounting firms.
Doing the consulting. Do you also see a similar type of conflict of interest scenario with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, where you have investment banks also doing the underwriting of a lot of these syndicated loans for companies like Enron, and also doing commercial banking as well?
Right. It's a great question. Robert Kuttner, Tom raises, first of all, this kind of new dynamic developed in the 90s where the accounting firms also developed consulting wings, and so they'd be consulting, then they'd be accounting, then you'd have an interest in the firm going forward, and who knows, but it looks like that may be what led Anderson, in this case, to some extent, to winking at these unorthodox accounting practices. What about Glass-Steagall and the banking face of this?
Well, it's not a popular viewpoint anymore, but I agree with the caller. I mean, I think either you're underwriting securities and bearing risk, or you are the fiduciary of somebody else's money, which is what a commercial bank does. It's awfully hard to be both. I think Glass-Steagall was a good thing. I think it's a travesty that it's been repealed.
But in the 90s, that came to look like old-fashioned thinking. You couldn't get the velocity you needed to make new things happen if you were mired in all that old regulation.
Sure, but in fact, the period of the regulated economy, the mixed form of capitalism, the late 40s through the early 70s, was the most sustained boom in the history of the American economy. So I think that period was a good balance between entrepreneurship and brakes and steering wheel. And if you throw away the brakes and the steering wheel, you have the kind of haywire operations that hurt investors, that hurt pensioners and workers, and there's nobody to hold these people accountable.
Listeners, who do you hold most culpable in the Enron debacle? What should we do about it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. You're asking the question about who we hold culpable, and Bob Kuttner has listed a lot of the usual suspects. Which reminds me of another line from Casablanca, which is the policeman saying, "I'm shocked to find gambling going on here." And by that I mean the business media. It seems that we leave out where reporting has played a role or kind of played a enabling role in allowing companies like Enron or a lot of the dot-com failures to ride the wave to appear far more important, far more successful than they are.
You're saying where was the press?
Well, absolutely. And I know that's a broad brush question, but I think it's worth asking. I think that a lot of the press is quite happy to go along for the ride when, you know, the times are good and the bubble is rising, and then when it comes down to sort of look around and try to find fault. It's not an accusation against the press, but really ask, what should their role be? How much more should they be asking when they see, you know, pro forma results reported as if it was real revenue and so forth? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Chris, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, how about it? I mean, you know, in all openness, in my little corner of the press, I was out cultivating one little patch of that whole internet thing, but a lot of the media was watching. What's your sense of how the press did in reporting these gangbuster stories like the Enron story in the late 90s?
Well, I'm not an expert on it, but my sense is that there was a lot of celebration going on. Magazines were even founded that seemed to be based on the premise of, you know, let's celebrate tomorrow's capitalist. And critical evaluation seemed to go by the board. And that's a very broad brush. Business Week magazine, for example, strikes me as a very solid publication, as does Fortune. And yet I've read pieces there over the years that just seem like puff pieces. And, you know, Fast Company magazine, just a series of puff pieces about people who are and in a way, this is a kind of failure of what the journalist was supposed to be part of this system of accountability. But from the and when you have the CNBC and the cable financial news network people who, you know, just routinely throughout the day reproduce what analysts are saying about the corporate, you know, this company looks good, the corporation looks good, and not telling us about any conflicts of interest the analyst might have because he's representing another wing of an investment banking firm that's giving money to the corporation whom they're touting. There's a kind of system of deception that's built up, and I think the press and the opening of new media, especially this cable news stuff, has played a role here.
But Robert Kuttner, there was also a germ of something positive and forward-looking in that reporting. Alan Greenspan's describing a new economy, higher levels of productivity, a kind of a new horizon that the whole country was pushing toward. Is the press entirely wrong to convey the excitement of that to its readership, to its listenership?
Yeah, I think most of it was bunk. Most of it was stock touts persuading people that this was something completely new in the history of capitalism. It wasn't. We had a dot-com bubble. Most of it burst. It's true that computer technology makes some people more productive some of the time, but that's really about all. And business,
you know, making some people productive some of the time can make a big difference over time.
Yeah, I'm sure it can. But I mean, how much time do you waste culling email, and how much time do you waste when your computer's down? I mean, I think there's a slight net gain, maybe a 0.5%, 0.75% per year, which gets the economy almost back to the growth rate of the 1940s and 50s and 60s. It was ballyhooed to death. And a lot of the business press was taken in. Business Week, which is kind enough to publish my column, did a very sober cover story 3 or 4 weeks ago on Enron, saying the whole business press was taken in. And I think with very few exceptions, it was.
Michael's on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I think some of this is tied up in part of the culture of capitalism, in what you might call the cult of the entrepreneur, the feeling that these are men, mostly, who are somehow not only clever and ambitious and energetic, but also in a way finer and purer than the weak-chinned bureaucrats who would try to regulate them.
So what are you saying exactly, Michael? That
there was a climate in which it was seen as not at all legitimate to really question what men like this did.
Jack Beatty, entrepreneurs have brought a lot to this economy. Michael's giving it to him on the chin. Where are you?
Well, I mean, I think that we need them, and they're vessels of innovation and change. But, it's a story really as old as the Founding Fathers. You can't leave people to their own devices. You've got to have checks and balances, especially within the financial area where so much of it depends upon transparency. And to the degree – I agree with you about this cult of the entrepreneur – to the degree that you know, cut people more slack than they otherwise would have, that's not good for entrepreneurialism. I mean, one of the big hits of this thing is capitalism. We've just seen that this thing can be can really rip people off, the employees, the stockholders. This was a tremendous blow for our system, the free enterprise system. So to the degree that the romance of the entrepreneur helped to make that possible, yeah, I agree. Less romance, more realism.
There's also a conceit that there is something more virtuous about trading than about making things. Enron took a great deal of pride in the fact that it didn't own anything. It didn't have any assets. All it did was trade. Well, it turned out to be a bubble.
Yes. Trying to move away from the material, they were very upfront about that. They didn't want to be just a colossus of pipes and girders. They wanted to be something that was digital.
Well, but I mean, ultimately, a lot of what is consumed, a lot of what goes into our living standards is tangible stuff. I mean, radio is a service. There, you can't point to radio. It's ephemeral or ethereal, but it's a service that's a real thing. A pure trading economy doesn't produce anything. It just plays the role of middleman.
We're going here into a critique of capitalism writ large, but Dan is on the line, maybe with a finer point. Dan, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, the point I want to make is I think there's a difference between capitalism and criminal behavior.
Hear, hear.
And I don't think that businesses go out of business. If one's trying hard and playing by the rules, that's one thing. But I think the fact that senior executives were allowed to sell their shares and their exercise their options while the corporate culture was that you don't do any of that, and then knowing what was going on underneath that to me is really more the criminal behavior than anything. I mean, clearly the offshore setups and the fact that they were doing partnerships and not making things transparent is one thing. But the fact to say that it's capitalism and people, you know, lost their opportunity, I don't think that's fair. I think the executives need to give back what they earned in the multis of millions of dollars, and they should start just the way the employee should. I think that that two-tiered structure, particularly with the criminal overlay, is where I think the rising tide comes, and ultimately, you know, there will be consequences.
We got it, Dan, and thanks for your call. Robert Cutton, we've just got a minute left, but briefly, how do you think the end game will play out here? How does this wrap back into the political culture? Will there be a change in ideology that runs out of this whole meltdown?
Yeah, I think there will be a swing of the pendulum back towards the idea that precisely because some capitalists some of the time will try to take everything that isn't nailed down, that you don't want the ordinary capitalist culture to slop over into the criminal culture. And in order to damp down that opportunism, that's why you have to have a degree of regulation so that capitalism can pursue the genius that it's capable of without degenerating into criminal behavior.
Jack Beatty, do you see that happening in this administration, that swing?
No, I don't. And I think Secretary O'Neill's comment yesterday, basically he said this is capitalism. And I agree with our caller, Dan. I mean, he was saying that, that criminality was capitalism. This is if that's their attitude, that then I don't see. And also they're just ideologically completely opposed to any thought that of you know, greater regulation and so on. So I don't think there's much hope here for change from them, but who knows?
Stay tuned. Robert Cutner, founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, thanks for joining us this hour. And Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. Listeners,
you
can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Matt Hommel was a web developer for Enron Online, working in the company's Houston headquarters. When Enron collapsed, he lost more than a job and a 401k.
I was part of the greatest team I had ever seen or heard of. We had unmatched talent and skill. We had a seemingly bottomless pool of experience to draw upon. We consistently displayed unyielding determination and unwavering resolve, but above all, an unbreakable commitment to help make Enron Online great. Throughout the decline, we did what we had always done. We did our best. We've all read the news. We all know the things that happened at Enron. And we all know the names of those to blame. At the end of it all, the truth is, bad things happen. For myself, I humbly asked for only one thing, the chance to rebuild Enron Online. I waited all day praying that I would get a call to tell me that my wish had been granted. Around 9 p.m., I got the call from the senior director that I hoped was good news. In the utmost professional manner, I was informed that there was no good news. Now it's over. I still get a bit choked up when I think about it. I don't work at Enron, and the team that I was part of has been scattered in the streets. I made some good friends at Enron, but I know I won't see many of them again. Enron took those friendships. Enron took my 401k. They took my stock options. They took away the day-old pastries that were always on the desk outside my office. They took away the free sodas and the big-screen TVs and the foosball table. They took away the free dinners we got on Friday nights during the new releases to the website. They took away the admin who always teased me because I ate like a pig and never gained weight. They took away the guy that beat me in foosball, despite the fact that he played with one hand and was carrying on a conversation on his cell phone while he played. They took away my boss and my coworkers, whom I considered a family. I loved my job, and in the end they took that too. But let me say this. I have my memories. I'm not going to ruin them with feelings of resentment or betrayal. I'm going to keep my memories. They belong to me.
Matt Hommel lives in League City, Texas. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. During the last hour, we inadvertently mentioned Morgan Stanley as one of the banks that underwrote Enron. We meant to say J.P. Morgan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.